The Rockies continue to struggle. A plethora of transactions have been made over the last 2 weeks. And let's talk Austin Gomber, Matt Caricitti, Pierce Johnson, Brenton Doyle, and Nolan Jones. This is Adjusting for Altitude.
Baseball is a difficult game. The average hitter gets on base in less than 40% of their plate appearances. Yet the average pitcher gives up 4 runs every 9 innings pitched. The sport is a challenge on its own. But at Altitude, the problems for baseball players compound. Less break on pitches, balls that fly significantly farther than at sea level, and then after playing in such a treacherous environment, the players play in normality for half of their regular season. Adjustments must be made by those who don the purple pinstripes of the Colorado Rockies. We discuss those adjustments here. This is Adjusting for Altitude with baseball fanatic and aspiring MLB general manager, Christopher Nelson II.
All right. We've made it through our technical difficulties, and at long last, I can say welcome to Adjusting for Altitude, a Colorado Rockies podcast analyzing the unique challenges faced by the only MLB team that plays a mile above sea level. Streaming on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and now live every Monday. Well, obviously today's not a Monday, it's Wednesday, but it's the inaugural episode, so it doesn't matter. Every Monday we'll be streaming, hopefully at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on YouTube, Twitter, and Twitch, which is where you can watch this going down at this moment in time. Right now, I am your host, Christopher Nelson II, and actually, I don't think host is the correct term. I think host might be a tad bit conservative. I'm kind of running the whole shebang here. I'm kind of more of a super host, if you will, monitoring the chat. I'm managing the on-screen production, content, and quality, and obviously, I'm still bringing you guys the actual Rockies content that you are here to see and listen to. So, I'm doing it all. Be patient with me. It's a learning process for sure, but we'll get through it and we're going to have fun in the process. But as the regular host of this podcast, it is my job, first and foremost, to remind you that if you haven't already listened to last week's episode, go ahead and do so. Now, I know some of you might be new to this podcast and you're like, why are we starting on episode 14? That doesn't seem to make much sense. Well, you're right, it doesn't make much sense because the previous 13 episodes are audio only. I just recently started exploring the idea of making this a video live podcast. So go ahead and listen to last week's episode on any of your favorite podcasting platforms. Last week's episode was actually 2 weeks ago's episode where we discussed the future of the Colorado Rockies. And we covered the team's top 30 prospects, read their scouting reports, and assessed the likelihood that each guy can contribute to the team in the future, near or far future for that matter. Spoiler alert, the Rockies preseason farm system ranking came in at about 14 out of 30 teams. So we went through and evaluated all the 30 prospects, and needless to say, considering the unique challenges presented by Coors Field, that is a very generous ranking. This farm system plays a lot lower than 14th, but that's all I'm going to say about last week's episode or 2 weeks ago's episode. You're gonna go have to listen to the rest of it. It was 2 hours long, so definitely spread it out over a few days if you have to, but it's definitely worth your listen. Go ahead and add it to your podcast queue. Also, if you haven't gone to follow me on social media yet, go ahead and do so. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at IamTheSecond. I'm gonna throw it on the screen for anyone who's watching this live right now. There you go. You can go follow me on Twitter and Instagram there. I use Instagram more, so if you want to contact me about anything Rockies baseball or, I don't know, just life in general, go ahead and hit me up there. I do see my DMs, and you're always welcome to drop in. We can talk. If you also want to reach me by email, you can reach me at adjustingforaltitude. I do see the emails that come through on there. But in using this new format, I'd like to get more viewer engagement. So we're going to start doing a question of the day on these episodes. And this week's question of the day is going to be, how long have you been a Rockies fan, and which of the team's 30 years of existence, seeing that we're obviously celebrating the team's 30 years of existence in Major League Baseball as an expansion team, which of those 30 years has been your most memorable? I think for me personally, I've been a conscious Rockies fan since I was about 11 years old, and my most favorite season or most memorable season that the team has experienced, I'm going to go with 2018. And 2018 was kind of the year that we put it together, 90-win season, and the whole shebang. Obviously, it didn't end the way any of us wanted it to, but I mean, if I were to look back right now in my brief life, 2018 was certainly my favorite of those years. Answer those questions in the comments below. Send me a DM, direct message, email me. However you want to answer those questions, go ahead and answer them. By the way, any answers to questions that are either questions for me or answers to questions or comments in general that I see in the comments section, which I'm going to do my best to keep track of throughout the night, those are going to be analyzed and answered on the subsequent episode. So I won't be addressing any of these comments that you guys might be commenting throughout the course of this stream tonight, but I will be responding to them on next week's episode, which will be on Monday. So when our regular streaming schedule is officially up and going, I will be answering questions in that manner. With that said, how about we hop into today's episode, ladies and gentlemen? So the Colorado Rockies are, well, the Colorado Rockies. Here's where they stand as of today, June 21st. Currently, the team is 29-48. They're fifth in the National League West, 13 games back of both first place in the NL West behind the Diamondbacks, and 13 games back of the final wild card spot. So needless to say, it's been a struggle. It has been a struggle indeed. After losing 2 of 3 against the Padres, the Rockies went on the road and actually found a way to take 2 of 3 from the Red Sox at Fenway, which was mighty impressive, before heading down to the ATL and getting curb stomped by arguably the best team in the National League, getting swept in that 4-game series with the Braves. And then they started this week off in Cincinnati. And for the most part, the games felt competitive, but ultimately the team they didn't have enough to get it done. And they got 3 games swept by Ellie De La Cruz and the Cincinnati Reds, who in and of themselves have an 11-game winning streak now. That's mighty impressive. Mighty impressive for that streaking Reds team. If you're going to bandwagon a team, since the Rockies have been pretty depressing and inconsistent over the last few weeks, the Reds are definitely my recommendation. They're young, they're up and coming. Go ahead and do so. But after the Reds finished off the sweep of the Rockies today, this afternoon, the Rockies' losing streak increased, to 8 games in a row. 8 straight losses. The pitching staff has given up at least 5 runs in 9 straight games, including 21 home runs over that span. That is absolutely crazy. So pitching has not been good. And the offense, which is supposed to, as of recently, come through in the clutch and kind of save the pitching from themselves, has also been unable to do so. The offense has only eclipsed 5 runs thrice over that same 9-game period, granted, a few major contributors are obviously missing. So that'd be your Charlie Blackmans of the world, your CJ Crones, your Chris Bryants, and a lot of younger guys have gotten more playing time recently. And that has its own struggles. So for various reasons, the offense being relatively non-existent makes sense. Overall, the team is still just figuring things out. I think that's the conclusion we can come to so far this season. And while there's definitely been some progress with the younger players, the team is still a ways away from competing in any reasonable manner, especially in the near future. With that said, there have been a decent amount of roster moves made over the last 2 weeks that I haven't been podcasting. But we're going to go through sort of the key ones. So let's talk about those transactions, shall we? This is the segment of the show that we like to call What's Been Going On.
The Colorado Rockies are a Major League Baseball organization with many happenings and occurrences. Chris, what's been going on?
All right. So the first transaction that we can go over is one that happened a decent while ago, but I thought was kind of important to discuss, because I feel like a move like this was a long time in the waiting. Coco Montes was promoted from AAA Albuquerque, and Alan Trejo was optioned. Alan Trejo was optioned to AAA. And, you know, this move makes sense for a variety of reasons. Number one, Coco Montes has actually been performing pretty darn well at AAA so far this season. So far in 2023, with the Isotopes, he's slashing 321, 401. and 961, obviously batting average, on base, and OPS in that order. You said 12 home runs, 47 runs driven in, 33 walks to 65 strikeouts. Definitely a solid player, I guess, especially for a guy in his mid-20s. I mean, those are the type of stats that get you knocking on the doorstep of making the major league team and getting an opportunity to contribute. Montes has been doing that, actually, knocking on the doorstep of the major leagues for a little while now. And considering that Trejo has just been completely subpar in 2023, slashing 241 with a 271 on base, 584 OPS, no home runs, 13 RBIs, in a platoon role at second base, where over the last few weeks before he got demoted, he was actually getting decent playing time, even against righties. For those of you who don't know what platoon means, by the way, it just means that he's playing every other day with another player. So they're kind of sharing playing time. Even despite him getting more time against righties, ultimately his inability to hit fastballs, like absolute inability to hit fastballs, it was coming. It was a long time coming. So to see Trejo get a chance to go down to AAA and just work through some of those technical things will be good for him. And it also gives a guy like Montes a chance at the majors to see what the Rocks have in some of their younger guys like Coco Montes. Another move that was made recently was Charlie Blackman getting placed on the 10-day IO with a right hand fracture. That's not what you want to see, especially for a Rockies team that's been struggling to find consistency offensively. He got hit by a pitch last week, and the fracture was severe enough that the team felt like it was necessary to make a move instead of keeping him active on the 26-man roster like they did with Jonathan Daza earlier in the year when Jonathan went through something similar after getting hit by a pitch and had a hand injury or a wrist injury, something along those lines. Ultimately, the corresponding move that was made when Chuck was placed on the injured list was to recall Brian Servin from AAA. And Brian never really played, so the Rockies, obviously not trusting Brian given his inability to perform at the majors this season, went out and they hit the free agent market and they picked up our good friend Jorge Alfaro. Yes, if you've watched any of the recent games that the Rockies have played, you'll know that there's a new face in the lineup who's been DHing. I think he caught one game in the ATL. And you might have been like, okay, who is that? So that is Jorge Alfaro. Jorge Alfaro is a major league veteran. He's been in MLB for, I think, 8 years. I think officially he has 5 years of major league service time under his belt. But he's been in the majors since like the mid-2010s. So his career stats are as such: 255 batting average, a 303 on base, 700 OPS, with a 28% caught stealing rate. So defensively, he's not the best, probably a little bit below average, but he's definitely a solid hitter. And at the end of the day, he can use those hitting skills to provide some value to a Rockies lineup that desperately needs some veteran presence in it. And again, even though he might be subpar defensively, just the fact that he is a veteran who can catch is definitely a plus for a Rockies team that doesn't have a ton of veteran experience at that position at all. So if the Rockies, ultimately, I think you'll take it. The other transaction that went down relatively recently was Denelson Lamet at long last getting DFA'd. That was also a move that was a little bit in the making. Unfortunately, in addition to Jose Urania, there have now been two Rockies who were signed to major league deals this offseason released before the season's even halfway over with. So ultimately, both Lamet's DFA and Urania's DFA both came down to the fact that neither one could really control their fastball command, or control for that matter. Control, obviously, is a pitcher's ability to pitch and hit their spots, while command is the pitcher's ability to hit their spots inside the strike zone and throw strikes. So Denelson never really did either of those very well. To me, it looks like he was kind of out of his technique throughout this season. Even going back to 2020, when he was a really good starter for the San Diego Padres in that COVID-shortened season, where he was like 200 or like 100% better, two times as good, I should say, as the major league average pitcher. It just never looked like he got back into that technique this season, or ever really, with the Rockies. And they just found a way to make it work as long as they could. ultimately, to me, it looked like he was a little bit late in his initial glove separation during his windup and stretch, for that matter, and he was never really able to adjust and speed back up that initial glove separation, and that really did impact his ability to throw strikes. Ultimately, they tried him as a reliever, didn't work. Tried it as a starter, didn't work. And now he's DFA'd. So we're going to see what ends up happening with Denelson Lamet. His ultimate final stat line with the Colorado Rockies in 2023 ended up looking like a 1-4 record with an 11.57 ERA in 25.2 innings pitched. He struck out 31 batters, walked 22, had a 6.59 FIP, a 2.34 WHIP, good for an ERA plus of 44, effectively meaning that he's 56% worse than the average MLB pitcher. Also good to see the corresponding move was to get Noah Davis back on the main squad. Noah was pretty solid for a younger guy who was, he had like, I think an inning's worth of experience after last season. It was just good to see him get called up again, because this season he started off fairly solidly. When he got promoted for the first time, he made some solid starts. Obviously had the one slip up at Coors Field against the D-backs a little while ago. But I mean, ultimately, I think Noah has some good second, third, fourth starter in the rotation type of potential with the solid five pitch mix that he has. So I think using 2023 as a good developmental year for him will put him in a very good position with the Rocks, especially in the long term. So good to see Noah get a chance. I think he actually started last night for the first time in a while. I think he gave up like three runs in four innings. I want to say something like that. So it'll be an adjustment period for him for sure, but we shall see how he readjusts to the major league level. Another transaction, this one happened relatively recently, was Connor Kizer getting promoted from AAA while Ezekiel Tovar was placed on the paternity list. Now, the Tovar family did welcome in a brand new human into the world this past weekend, so it would make sense that Ezekiel Tovar would take some time off to be with his wife, his family, just for a little bit of time. But some people were a little bit surprised by the fact that Connor Kizer got the promotion instead of another guy like maybe an Aaron Shunk, who's in the top 30 prospects of the Rockies organization, seeing that Shunk is one of those guys who the Rockies have invested in as a guy they drafted and would like to see contribute at the major league level. Promoting a guy like Connor Kizer, who's bounced back and forth between a few organizations over the last four or so years, didn't really seem to make sense. But honestly, that's why they promoted Connor Kizer instead of a guy like Aaron Shunk. Tovar is the everyday shortstop for the club and hopefully will be for the next like decade plus. He's not going to be out for terribly long with the paternity leave. So to promote a prospect that the club feels more invested in and would like to see become a regular at some position in all likelihood in the near future, just to send him down like a little while later probably doesn't feel right for the front office. So ultimately, it's easier to play that card with a guy like Kizer, who's not amazing, but he's good enough to hold down the spot, maybe on the bench or play short every so often as he has or did during the Red Series. I think he started two of those games. Ultimately, that's the reason why they promoted Kizer. Kizer's stats at AAA are looking like this. They're like 278 is the batting average, 376 is the on-base, with an 882 OPS. He's hit 7 home runs, 26 RBIs, 27 walks to 50 strikeouts, and 6 stolen bases. So, I mean, it's a solid. He's a solid player. He's been a solid player at AAA this season. Ultimately, they didn't want to make that commitment by promoting a whole prospect that they would like to see become a regular. And that's why that ultimately makes sense. But the last piece of news that we're going to get to on this segment is a trade that, in my opinion, not only made no sense at all, but from multiple perspectives, might go down, in my opinion, as one of the 10 worst trades that have been made by this franchise over the last decade. All right, that's how ultimately bad this is. And a lot of the people who listen to this either right now live or after the fact are probably not going to know who this is or really care a whole ton about this guy, because he hasn't really contributed much at the major league level. In fact, he threw one inning in a very brief appearance at the major league level before getting sent back down to AAA. The Rockies over the weekend traded Blair Calvo to the Detroit Tigers for cash considerations. I know, blockbuster trade. It's going to have so many people just absolutely fuming. But hear me out. You're going to have to hear me out on this. Where should I begin, first off? Because that's how bad this trade is to me. From multiple perspectives, that said. I guess we'll start here. Blair Calvo was traded to the Tigers over the weekend, mostly because the Rockies had previously DFA'd him earlier in the week. And if you'll recall how the DFA system works, DFA, by the way, means designated for assignment, you'll know that a team has 7 days from announcing that a player has been DFA'd to either trade that player or release him to outright waivers. So the Rockies had 7 days from DFAing him earlier in that week to make that decision. Now, you might be asking, reasonably so, why was Blair Calvo DFA'd anyways? Blair Calvo was DFA'd to make room for the aforementioned Jorge Alfaro, funny enough. Jorge was not on the 40-man roster earlier in the week, and in order to be promoted to the 26-man roster, the active roster, a player has to be on the 40-man roster initially. So if the 40-man roster is full, a player has to be released to outright waivers and traded or DFA'd in order to make space for that new player on the 40-man roster. Now, like I said earlier, Brian Servin, who was on the 40-man roster, was optioned to AAA to make room for Alfaro on the 26-man roster. That was just to make room for him on the 26-man. That was not a move that was made to remove Servin from the 26-man and the 40-man roster while adding Alfaro to the 40-man roster in place of Servin. Servin easily could have been DFA'd with minimal issue. Like, the Rockies currently have 3 catchers on the major league roster and multiple catching prospects coming up throughout the system. Brian Servin, for all intents and purposes, is expendable in this instance. Like, that's just the way it is. He should have been the one DFA'd to make room on the 40-man for Alfaro, another catcher. It would have been an even catcher-for-catcher swap. But instead, Calvo was DFA'd. And Calvo, since he was on the 40-man roster, ultimately, the Rockies were faced with the situation. They have to trade him or just release him on outright waivers. And Calvo's too good, so obviously the Rockies were going to try and get something for him. But ultimately, the pitcher for catcher swap on the 40-man roster, unless there's something that the front office was thinking about that I'm just completely missing, makes literally no sense. Like, no sense at all. Pitcher for catcher swap, especially that pitcher for that catcher, considering the other catcher who has been given multiple chances and is yet to show that he can contribute at the major league level, gets to remain on the 40-man roster? Like, the whole thing is just ultimately confusing. This transaction made no sense at all. But speaking of Calvo being a well-regarded depth piece for the bullpen, which is ultimately what he was, earlier in the spring, he started to make some headlines as a guy who could contribute at the major league level as soon as this season, which he did. I mean, he pitched an inning. That's not a ton, but he's ultimately there. He's on the border. He's been a well-regarded depth piece for a while, but since he's been that, let's just talk about his profile as a pitcher, because this is the second perspective that appears to have been completely overshadowed in this particular instance. Calvo, so far at AAA in 2023, has posted stats that look like this. He's 2-3 with a 7.43 ERA, a 1.7 whip. In 23 innings pitched, he's given up 3 home runs, but he struck out 32 and only walked 10 batters. This is all while pitching in a league, the PCL, the Pacific Coast League, I believe is the abbreviation or what it stands for, that is well known for offensive output. So for a variety of reasons, PCL teams just know how to score runs well. It's one of the most offensive heavy leagues in all of professional baseball, both at the pros, at the major league level and the minor league level. So it makes sense that pitcher stats in this league are more inflated. And that is the observation across different organizations as well. So for Calvo stats to look a little bit inflated isn't necessarily a problem. While they might not look the prettiest, they're pretty solid, all things considered. But even aside from the stats, Calvo just profiles well as a pitcher who can succeed within the challenges presented by Coors Field. Like, it's rare that you come across those, and especially, it's even more especially rare, rather, I should say, that you have one within your organization naturally. So we've talked in depth on this podcast previously about the ideal build of a pitcher who can succeed at Coors Field in the long term. Part of that ideal build for a pitcher would be to throw a low spin rate fastball and a high spin rate slider, a low spin rate changeup, and a low spin rate curveball. Now, like I said, we've talked about this in depth on previous episodes. So if you'd like to hear me talk about these issues in more depth, you can go back and listen to those. But just in general, that's the consensus or the conclusion that I've come to personally. That's the ideal build for a pitcher who wants to succeed at Coors Field. So this objectively is the best way to counter the challenges of the Magnus effect at high altitude, which is why we want low spin rates on pitches like fastballs and curveballs, because of the way that those pitches move and spin throughout the air at a ballpark where the air density is a lot higher or lower. The air is thinner is what I'm trying to say. So Blair Calvo, funny enough, fit the mold perfectly. Now, I don't know if that's something they were trying to do by like actually searching for that when they found a guy like Calvo in, I think the draft is where they would have gotten him. I don't know if that was intentional, but if it was intentional or not, ultimately the case is that he fits that profile with a two-pitch mix of a slider and a sinker, both of which meet those basic requirements for succeeding at Coors Field, that ideal Coors Field pitcher's mold. His sinker is roughly 400 RPMs below major league average, which is perfect. Sinker is also a type of fastball, by the way, so that counts as a low spin rate fastball. And his slider is roughly 200 RPMs above major league average. And you add in the fact that he possesses great strikeout to walk potential, like he's already demonstrated at AAA this season. I mean, with some technical development, I had little doubt that within the next few years, Blair Calvo could have been a solid contributor to this Rockies bullpen. Now, unfortunately, that's no longer the case. But the third perspective that completely baffled me about this trade was the trade itself and like what it actually was. I get that if you DFA a player, your negotiation abilities in a trade are significantly impacted, and that you typically DFA a player that you no longer want in your organization or on your major league roster. So to ask for something decent in return gets a lot harder when trading a player who's been DFA'd as compared to if you were just making a regular straight up trade. Nonetheless, the value lost with Calvo far exceeds what they got back in return for him. Cash considerations? Like cash. Probably some several hundred dollars, because that's probably about what Calvo's contract was worth, and I doubt that the Tigers gave up somewhere in the millions worth of cash considerations for a guy who has one innings worth of major league experience. So, great. That means you got several hundred thousand dollars back in return, at most, for a reliever who had the potential, all the potential in the world, to be a solid contributor to this major league bullpen as soon as this year. Seems like a loss, to say the least, to me. But you live with your losses, and you hope that you can pick up wins in the future. Ultimately, that's what's been going on recently from a transactional perspective within the Colorado Rockies organization. Now it's time to discuss some in-depth analytics and adjustments for the gentleman donning the purple pinstripes. This is the bread and butter of the Adjusting for Altitude podcast. Three Rockies pitchers, two Rockies position players, five-man analysis is next on Adjusting for Altitude, so stay tuned. We're back in 60 seconds.
The Magnus effect is defined as the force exerted on a rapidly spinning cylinder or sphere moving through the air or another fluid in a direction at an angle to the axis of spin. This force is responsible for the swerving of balls when hit or thrown with spin. The impact of the Magnus effect on a spinning cylinder or sphere at different altitudes is ultimately what makes playing baseball in Colorado significantly harder than most other states. With the lower atmospheric air density present in a city such as Denver, Colorado, less air resistance is experienced by the flying projectiles, in this context, a Major League Baseball. Pitches break less in any direction, batted balls fly farther, and the larger ballpark built to lessen the likelihood of a hitter's paradise in Denver only allows for more poorly batted fly balls to drop in the outfield. This is why playing baseball at altitude is a significant challenge for most who dare to succeed within the industry of Major League Baseball.
And welcome back to this episode of Adjusting for Altitude. I hope you enjoyed that little tidbit. Yeah, it's good. It's kind of like the advertisement fill for this part of the stream. So it works nicely. It works both ways. Ultimately, five-man analysis is what I would consider one of the most unique segments of any Rockies-related content, or MLB-related content that, for that matter, that can be found across the World Wide Web. On this segment, I discuss advanced analytics and sabermetrics that pertain to five players that can that are currently on the Colorado Rockies roster or have contributed to the team at some point this season in some regard. And I make my own unique predictions about these players, and I suggest some adjustments that they should make based on the analysis that I've made previously. Although I do get into advanced analytics, sabermetrics, etc., I think that the typical Rockies fan, or MLB fan for that matter, can find this segment entertaining to some degree, whether you feel like you're a baseball nerd or whether you don't feel like you're a baseball nerd and you consider yourself more of a casual person who enjoys the game, not necessarily from the statistics perspective or the analytics perspective. I think there's something for everyone on this segment, and I truly think that this is what makes this show as unique as it is. With that said, this is Five Man Analysis.
Using advanced MLB analytics and eye test comparisons, let's discuss the performance of five Colorado Rockies thus far this season. This is Five Man Analysis.
And we're going to kick off today's segment of Five Man Analysis with player number one.
Player number one.
All right, so player number one is currently the second starter in the Colorado Rockies rotation. And he ideally wouldn't be the second starter in this rotation, but you know, a variety of injuries to the starting rotation has caused the rotation to shift a little bit. So who am I talking about? Well, I am talking about none other than our good friend, Austin Gomber. Austin Gomber, currently on the season, has a stat line that looks like this. So far, he is 4-7 with a 7.25 ERA. In 72 innings pitched, he has 50 strikeouts, 28 walks, a 6.49 FIP, a 1.64 WHIP, good for an ERA plus of 69, which again dictates that he is 31% worse than the average MLB pitcher. And off the bat, no pun intended, I guess, we initially see that Gomber has regressed a little bit since we last discussed his contributions on this podcast back in mid-May. So back when we discussed him for the first time, his WHIP at that time was 1.59. Obviously, it's gone up. His FIP at that time was 5.77. Obviously, that's gone up. His ERA plus at that time was 74, meaning that he was at that point in time only 26% worse than the average MLB pitcher. This is the pitch mix that Gomber is working with so far in 2023. He throws the four-seam fastball with a usage rate of 42% at 91 miles per hour. He throws a changeup with a 21% usage rate, 82 miles per hour. He throws a curveball 19% of the time with 19% usage rate at 78 miles an hour. He throws the slider 17% of the time at 85 miles per hour. And he works in a sinker, I guess, 2% of the time at 91 miles per hour. It's effectively the same as his four-seam fastball. Ultimately, not a ton of significant change has occurred in his arsenal over the last month or so. He's using the fastball a bit less than he was a month ago and using the slider a bit more than he was a month ago. No surprise that he hasn't really altered his changeup and curveball usage over that time as well. They've easily been his best pitches so far this season. That batting average against on those two pitches respectively is 254 and 224, and their expected batting average against, meaning the expected batting average on those pitches if all circumstances or based on circumstances that have occurred previously in Major League Baseball, is 270 and 206 respectively. So obviously you can respect those stat lines, and the weighted on base average and expected weighted on base average for those pitches is respectable as well. All in all, since he's been a below average pitcher in 2023, it's no surprise that Gomber finds himself in the blue or below average in most of MLB's percentile rankings. He's in the 16th percentile of average exit velo surrendered, the 17th percentile of hard hit percentage, the 21st percentile of barrel percentage, the 8th percentile of strikeout percentage, the 44th percentile of walk rate, the 12th percentile of whiff rate, and the 6th percentile of chase rate. So he has not been a very good pitcher, needless to say, in 2023. And that's the obvious conclusion we can draw about him. He's not a good starting pitcher. And he really only at most has fourth or fifth starter in the rotation type of potential. But from a pitch build perspective, we love to see that he has a low spin rate fastball. I think his the spin rate on that pitch is like 2250 or something like that. It's a little bit higher than is ideal, but it works. It's low enough. And although he doesn't really experience success with that pitch, despite it being built kind of in a way that could succeed at Coors Field, his four-seam fastball has a batting average against of 377 with an expected batting average against of 393. Yikes. While he throws a pitch about 91 miles per hour on average, the expected exit velo of that pitch is 95 miles per hour. Yikes. With an average launch angle of 14 degrees. So take that as you will. Needless to say, hitters are smacking his four-seam fastball, the pitch that he throws most of the time, may I remind you. Similarly, his slider has a batting average against of 328 with an expected batting average against of 288. Sure, that's better, but it's not much better. The average exit velo on that pitch is 90 miles per hour. Again, significantly harder than the velo he throws the pitch at, being 85 miles per hour. The launch angle on his slider is about 9 degrees. So again, take that as you will. Overall, it's easy to say that Gomber's fastball and slider are his two least effective pitches and are the two pitches that he's been messing around with over the last month or so, as demonstrated by the fact that only those two have seen significant usage rate changes of about 3% or so over that period of time. But let's compare Gomber to a pitcher that profiles similarly to him from a pitch distribution and pitch build perspective. This pitcher that I would compare him to, as suggested by Baseball Savant, is Patrick Sandoval. Patrick Sandoval is our good friend who pitches for the Los Angeles Angels. Currently in 2023, Sandoval has the following stat line. He is 4-6 with a 4.08 ERA. He, in 70.2 innings pitched, has 54 strikeouts to 29 walks. He has a 4.03 FIP. He has a 1.42 whip, good for an ERA plus of 107, which means he is 7% better than the average MLB pitcher. And this is the pitch distribution that Sandoval has achieved this with so far in 2023. Currently, he's rocking with the slider 30% of the time at 86 miles per hour. He throws the changeup 27% of the time at 83 miles an hour. The four-seam 26% of the time at 92 miles per hour. The curveball 9% of the time at 76 miles per hour. And he throws a sinker 8% of the time at 92 miles per hour, with a sweeper thrown in like 1% of the time at 82 miles per hour. The difference between a sweeper and slider isn't much. It's just that the sweeper has a lot more horizontal movement rather than vertical for a slider. That's really the only difference. So I don't know if that's like a statistical error that they like picked up him throwing a slider and they just called it a sweeper. Whatever it may be, there are definitely some similarities in these two pitchers, needless to say. First, we would notice that both struggle using their fastballs. Sandoval has a batting average against of 333 and an expected batting average of 280 on his fastball. Both also feature a changeup and a breaking ball that are the highlights of their arsenals, being the best pitches that they throw, with Sandoval's changeup and slider having batting averages against of 204 and 258, respectively, and expected batting averages against of 252 and 262, respectively. But the key difference between Gomber and Sandoval ultimately is that Sandoval uses his best pitches more and more balanced as well. So he's better at mixing and matching those pitches in a way that gives him a more balanced repertoire. Gomber's usage rate on his fastball, breaking ball, and changeup is 42%, 19%, and 21%, respectively. Sandoval's usage rate on the same three pitches in the same respective order, 28.6%, 30%, and 27%. Sandoval has found good success by doing this and balancing those three pitches, taking off some pressure from his fastball to have to carry the load of his arsenal, so to speak. And I think Gomber should take a similar approach, in all honesty, using his changeup and curveball more. They are objectively his better pitches. He needs to use them frequently and earlier in counts to set up his fastball to be more effective in later counts, even despite his lack of ability to command that pitch in the zone. And since he doesn't fit the ideal mold of a Coors Field pitcher, given his low velo fastball and the fact that he doesn't throw an efficient slider or an effective slider for that matter, I'd suggest that he use that slider less and focus more on his three most used pitches, finding a good balance for that four seam, that changeup, that curveball, and maybe balance those three to the tune of something like 30%, 24%, 28%, like respectively. If he can achieve a balance like that and that trend were to bring him success, which I think it would definitely bring him to the point where he could improve his standing within effectiveness and being a good pitcher in terms of Major League Baseball. And Patrick Sandoval has seen success with it with a similar build. So, I mean, it's worth a try. Why not? In his starts, you're going to want to watch to see if Gomber uses his changeup and curveball earlier in counts. And you're also going to watch to see how effectively his fastball plays off of those two pitches. If he's attacking hitters more with that balanced approach, then I definitely expect him to succeed more in that outing.
Player number two.
So player number two is currently a middle inning reliever for the Colorado Rockies. And this man is Matt Caracitti. Matt Caracitti was picked up over the offseason. I believe he was signed as a free agent. He's been through a lot over the last few years, injuries and all. He was actually originally drafted by the Colorado Rockies a long, long time ago, back in like 2013, I want to say. But ultimately, so far in 2023, this is what Matt's stats look like. So far, he is 1-0 with a 5 ERA. In 18 innings pitched, he has struck out 8 batters. He has walked 9. He has a 5.5 FIP, a 1.33 WHIP, good for an ERA plus of 101, making him a whole 1% better than the average MLB pitcher. Look at Matt go. Look at him. This is amazing. This is the first time that we've discussed Matt Caracitti on this podcast, and initially we see that Matt has been okay. Like, he's been okay. I know he's above average technically, but I think he's just been okay. He's been okay in the role that he's been placed in with the team so far, considering that he had Tommy John surgery at some point during the last 3 years. I think it was in 2020 or 2021. To see that he's technically an above average major league pitcher at this point in his career is very encouraging, especially for him, I'm sure. So it's even more impressive once we dive into the pitches that he's used so far in 2023, I guess, because the pitches that he's been rocking with in 2023 have not been many. He's rocking with a whole three. He throws a sinker 70% of the time at 95 miles per hour. He throws a forkball 25% of the time at 82 miles per hour, and he throws a cutter 5% of the time at 92 miles per hour. And with those pitches respectively, he's generating a batting average against of 178, 316, and 333, with an expected batting average of 262, 186, and 384 respectively. Based on this, an interesting observation that we can actually make would be that his sinker is somehow playing better than it should be, and his forkball is playing worse than it should be. I have no idea why that is. For whatever reason, it feels like that will even out over the course of time. That's the point of expected statistics. When we say something is expected to be playing at this particular, say, batting average, so a pitch is supposed to have a batting average against of this particular batting average, that's ideally demonstrating that that pitch should be better, and vice versa, like I just kind of briefly explained. He hasn't pitched enough this season to be considered across the broader array of MLB percentile rankings, but we do know that he's been fairly effective and that he does throw a high velocity, low spin rate fastball, an absolute plus for a Coors Field pitcher, with an off speed pitch too that has a speed differential of over 10 miles per hour. So obviously he throws that fastball significantly faster than he throws that forkball. Again, in reference to my ideal Coors Field pitcher mold, that's absolutely fantastic, hands down. A breaking pitch doesn't seem to be in development for Matt in the near future, if at all. Obviously, the Tommy John surgery might have something to do with that, but ultimately, I don't think it'll be necessary for him to have a breaking ball in order to experience success. Baseball Savant doesn't really have a player comp for him at the moment, but personally, I think our good friend Brent Suter is a very good comparison to Caracitti at the moment. Funny enough, Caracitti does share a bullpen with Brent, which is my comparison for him. So they both kind of share a similar role also in the Rockies bullpen. Suter's kind of more of that like fifth, sixth, seventh inning, sort of middle inning reliever, often called upon to pitch like two or so innings if need be. We'll definitely cover Brent again in a future episode in more detail, but currently in 2023, this is what Brent's stats look like. So he's rocking with a 4-0 record, a 2.81 ERA in 41.2 innings pitched. He has 33 strikeouts to 14 walks, a 3.4 FIP, a 1.18 WHIP, good for an ERA plus of 179. Now, obviously, he's been a lot worse and less effective over the last week or so, last few outings. So these numbers are definitely higher than they should have been, but ultimately, he's still been pretty good, all things considered. And Brent is achieving this stat line with this pitch distribution. So he's throwing a sinker 33% of the time at 88 miles an hour, a four-seam fastball 30% of the time at 86 miles per hour, a changeup 28% of the time at 76 miles per hour, and a slider 9% of the time at 76 miles per hour. So in terms of the differences, we obviously would note that Caricetti throws much harder than Brent Suter does. Like, that's pretty obvious. However, in terms of similarities, we notice that both have really good speed differentials between their fastballs and their off-speed pitches. And both of them do throw low spin rate fastballs and off-speed pitches, effectively rendering the need for those breaking pitches useless in their particular role in the Rockies bullpen. Suter's sinker and four-seam fastball are pretty much indistinguishable, at least when watching in person. So say we just combine them into one category and just said he throws a fastball, we can say that Brent throws a fastball 63% of the time and his changeup 28% of the time. This is how he's kept hitters off balance and, despite his inability to strike out a ton of batters, maintain his status as one of the more effective relievers in Major League Baseball thus far in 2023, even despite his recent struggles. As such, I think that an adjustment that I'd suggest for Caricetti would be to follow suit, do something similar. Usually I'm a proponent of starting pitchers developing a cutter if they already throw a sinker, or vice versa, starting to throw a sinker if they already throw a cutter. But for relievers, especially middle inning relievers, that's not always necessary for success. Working in a third pitch every once in a while can't hurt. So Caricetti should definitely keep throwing that cutter in every once in a while with his arsenal. But in terms of his two most used pitches, his sinker and his forkball, balancing that usage rate to something like 60-30 or even 55-35 respectively might benefit Caricetti and help him keep batters off balance more, considering the speed differential that he has at play. Like, the difference between 95 and 81, 82 is pretty substantial. So we'll have to monitor that over the next month or so. In his relief appearances, though, you're going to want to watch how balanced of an attack Caricetti uses, especially with that sinker and forkball, and how hitters are responding to that speed differential. So if he's using both of those very effectively, maybe in like a sort of 60-40, 50-50 type of manner, just considering those two pitches, not his entire arsenal, I definitely expect him to have a successful outing on that particular day.
Player number three.
Player number three is currently a late inning reliever for this Colorado Rockies team after recently being removed from the closer's role. I, of course, am talking about Pierce Johnson. Now, Pierce had some promise at the beginning of the year. He was signed to a one-year deal over the offseason. It's sort of like, okay, we need to fill out a spot in our bullpen. Pierce, would you like to jump on? Obviously, he's from Colorado, so hard to turn that down as a Colorado kid. Oh, go play for the hometown team. But so far in 2023, although he started off a lot stronger than he has been recently, his stat line suggests that he's more so the regressed version of Pierce Johnson that we've seen over the last few weeks. So far in 2023, he's 0-3 with 12 saves in 14 save opportunities, a 7.07 ERA in 28 innings pitched. He struck out 40 batters. He's walked 18. He has a 5.14 FIP, a 1.86 WHIP, good for an ERA plus of 71. He is 29% worse than the average MLB pitcher. Very, very unfortunate. Similarly to Austin Gomber, Johnson has regressed since we last discussed his contributions in early May on another podcast episode. Only difference is that he's regressed substantially. His whip at that time was 1.68. Here are his stats again as of this point in the season. His FIP at that time was 4.51. His ERA plus at that time was 131, meaning that he was 31% better than the average MLB pitcher. And look where we are today. So this is the distribution pitch-wise that Pierce is working with in 2023. He's throwing his curveball about 50% of the time at 85 miles per hour. He's throwing his four-seam 43% of the time at 96 miles per hour, and he's throwing the slider 7% of the time at 87 miles per hour. Now, the significant change in his arsenal over the last month or so is that he's using the fastball a bit more than he was a month ago, but he's using the curveball a lot less because he's added that third pitch with that slider that he wasn't initially using when we made our first observation and evaluation of his performance earlier in May. Earlier in May, he was using his curveball 62% of the time and the four-seam fastball 38% of the time when it was just that two-pitch mix that he was working with as the closer. Unfortunately, these changes that he's made haven't really made him better. And in terms of MLB percentile rankings, Johnson is now below average in more categories than he used to be. He's now in the 8th percentile of average exit velo surrendered, the 4th percentile of hard hit percentage, 23rd percentile of barrel percentage, 85th percentile, positively enough, of strikeout rate, 7th percentile of walk rate, 80th percentile of whiff rate, and the 26th percentile of chase rate. Now, I didn't mention specifics last time we talked about him on the podcast, otherwise I would have compared them directly on this show, but he has substantially regressed. That's ultimately what you need to know since the last time we talked about him, especially in terms of average exit velo surrendered, hard hit percentage, barrel percentage, and walk rate. He used to be significantly higher, and I believe in average exit velo, hard hit, and barrel percentage, he was actually in the upper echelons of major leagues in those percentile categories when we talked about him last. And even in those categories that he's improved in, the improvement hasn't been substantial. And you know what? This might just be my fault. I might have accidentally somehow been responsible for the fall of Pierce Johnson. Now, what do I mean by that? Back when I originally analyzed Pierce, I was under the impression that a high spin rate curveball would play and should play well at Coors Field. And I loved the fact that Johnson's curveball was in the upper echelons of the league in that regard. I think even today, he's like in the 95th percentile of like curveball spin rate. He's got like 29 RPMs, 2900, not 29. If he had 29 RPMs on his curveball, I think I'd be a little bit concerned. But 2900, he was around 21 or 2900 RPMs on that pitch. I think he still is. That's a really high spin rate curveball, like super high spin rate. Unfortunately, relatively recently, I proved myself wrong, concluding that a lower spin rate curveball is actually better and more deceptive at and away from Coors Field, especially if you're a pitcher who pitches at Coors Field and not just a pitcher who pitches elsewhere and visits Coors Field like once in a blue moon. I think a low spin rate curveball is better for Coors Field pitchers than a high spin rate curveball. If you want to hear my full take on that particular issue, episode 12 is the episode you should go add to your podcast queue. I talked about it in a decent amount of length before we got into five-man analysis on that episode. But ultimately, it turns out that that very important realization has significantly changed my view of Pierce Johnson as a pitcher who can consistently succeed at altitude. Rather than being encouraged by that piece of information, I should have been highly discouraged. And now we might be starting to see why. One telltale sign that Johnson's curveball, the pitch that he throws, obviously, most of the time, isn't built to succeed at Coors Field is the batting average against and the expected batting average on that pitch, respectively, 260 and 190. His curveball should be better than it is. Ultimately, it isn't. So the Coors effect aspect, how does Coors Field play into this? Well, a little bit more digging found that Johnson's curveball actually drops 4 inches less than the average MLB curveball, despite being in the 95th percentile of spin rate. The average MLB curveball has a spin rate of about 2,600 RPMs. Johnson's curveball has a spin rate of 2,900 RPMs. obviously higher than the major league average. He should, at a minimum, be getting more vertical drop on that pitch, but he isn't even getting the same amount of vertical drop on that pitch. That's crazy. This aspect of his game effectively sinks his so-called success ship. But now let's compare him to a pitcher that profiles similarly to him. And I think a good comparison for Pierce Johnson, all things considered, is Ryan Pressly. Now, Ryan Pressly, obviously he's a closer for the Houston Astros. If you've been watching baseball over the last few years, the Astros have been pretty successful. You've probably seen a decent amount of Ryan Pressly, especially if you've tuned into any Astros postseason games over that time span. In 2023, Pressly has a record of 1-2 with a 3.26 ERA in 30.1 innings pitched. He has 32 strikeouts to 7 walks, a 3.15 FIP, a 1.06 WHIP, and a 130 ERA plus. So he's 30% better than the average MLB pitcher. And Pressly has achieved this stat line with the following pitches. He throws a slider 46% of the time at 90 miles an hour, a curveball 25% of the time at 82 miles per hour, a four-seam fastball 22% of the time at 94 miles per hour, and a changeup 7% of the time at 90 miles per hour. Pressly generates the highest spin rate of any pitcher in the sport with this particular setup that he has, whatever his technique is. It's resulting in him getting RPMs of 3,200 on that curveball, while Johnson's hovers right around 2,900 RPMs, like I said earlier. Either way, both of them throw easily some of the spinniest curveballs in the league. The difference between the 100th percentile and the 95th percentile, for all intents and purposes, in this instance, are pretty much the same. Additionally, Pressly throws his curveball only 3 miles per hour slower than Johnson does on average. So there's minimal difference in the curveballs thrown by both pitchers. The expected batting average on Presley's curveball is 185, compared to Johnson's curveball expected batting average of 190. They look very similar. However, Presley's actual batting average against is 167. Johnson's, of course, is 260. Oh, and remember how Johnson's curveball had roughly 4 inches less of vertical break compared to the MLB average pitcher's curveball? Well, Pressly's breaks roughly 4 inches more vertically than the MLB average curveball does. Quick estimation would suggest that Johnson, at a minimum, should be somewhere around 2 to 3 inches more in terms of vertical break than the average MLB curveball with that pitch. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the Coors Field effect. So despite having arguably the best curveball in the majors, Pressly throws his slider most of the time and sees good success with it. His slider profiles also very similarly to Johnson's, funny enough, with minimal velocity and RPM difference between the two. I don't have the specifics in front of me at the moment, but ultimately, I think Pierce should take note. A slider does play within about a half an inch worth, both vertically and horizontally, between Coors Field and away from Coors Field, making it easily the more superior breaking pitch that you want to throw if you are a pitcher who calls Coors Field your home. You want that maneuverability, and you don't want to have to worry substantially or significantly about that difference in pitch break. It's effectively the same everywhere you pitch with a slider. So if Johnson wants to succeed here, that slider is definitely going to need to be used way more than it currently is. In his relief appearances, you're going to want to watch how often Johnson uses his slider. Although I don't really expect him to use that pitch more than 10% of the time at most, you're going to want to observe its effectiveness in its limited usage. If by some chance he uses it more, I'd expect him to succeed more in that particular outing. So those are the analytics behind a few Colorado Rockies pitchers. We're going to dive into some hitters on the hitters segment of five-man analysis in just a second, or actually 60 seconds. Adjusting for Altitude returns then. Stay tuned.
As a smaller market Major League Baseball organization, the Colorado Rockies heavily rely on the draft and develop process to achieve success amidst their strugglesome circumstances. This process involves a greater reliance on drafting and signing young talent, patiently developing them within their minor league system until the organization believes they are ready to compete at the major league level. The Rockies have been more successful at developing hitters within their organization, players who can hit for average, power, and battle deep into counts on a relatively consistent basis. both at the hitter's paradise of Coors Field and on the road as well. In terms of pitching, the organization has struggled to produce successful homegrown depth in that regard. But historically, smart trades and free agent signings have been the primary way that the team plugs holes in the starting rotation and bullpen, both at the major league and minor league levels. The mastery of the draft and develop system will be crucial for the Rockies if they want to achieve sustained, long-term success at some point in the future.
All right, welcome back to Five Man Analysis. We're going to continue the discussion on today's episode with player number four. Player number four is currently the primary center fielder for the Colorado Rockies, batting either leadoff or in the ninth spot in the lineup as a right-handed batter, a prospect who made his long-awaited debut this season in 2023. That player, of course, is Brenton Doyle. Brenton Doyle so far has been fairly impressive. Fairly might be an understatement, all things considered. But so far in 2023, this is how the rookie has started his major league career. So in 45 games, he is batting .216 with a .272 on base percentage, good for an OPS of .617. He's hit four home runs, driven in 18 runs. He struck out 50 times, walked 11 times. He's 10 out of 12 in stolen base attempts, and that's good for an OPS plus of 60. So obviously he's 40% worse than the average MLB hitter, but to be fair, that is expected. All things considered, he is a rookie. There is an adjustment period to be made. Brenton hasn't played enough to be considered across the broad array of the MLB percentile rankings, a lot like Matt Caricity, who we discussed earlier. But we do know that he's in the 68th percentile of max exit velo off the bat, and he's in the 96th percentile of sprint speed. And he's in the 99th percentile of arm strength as well. So I don't have a comparison to discuss today for Doyle. But my conclusion ultimately about him remains the same as it did when I talked about him for the first time. He has superstar potential. And that might be an understatement. He has demonstrated each of the five tools that make him a five-tool baseball player on multiple occasions so far this season. And he's only played 45 games. It's impressive. The five tools, for those of you who are wondering what a five-tool baseball player is it's just a way that scouts identify a hitter's ability or a baseball player who's a position player, not a pitcher, obviously. It's just a way that they identify and are able to classify certain prospects in certain ways. So the five tools of a baseball player are hitting ability, just in general, the ability to hit for power, the person's or the player's speed, their arm strength, and their fielding. So ultimately, Brenton has, like I said, displayed that beautifully in several instances so far this season. Between the solid exit velo that he's demonstrated, whether it be on extra base hits or home runs, stolen bases, diving catches, throwing runners out at the plate. Like, you can name anything you want that a baseball player could do that sounds cool. Brenton has probably done it, and I will continue to maintain that he has an absolutely bright future ahead. Now, I've been pretty adamant that I do not like closed stances. Closed stances bother the heck out of me as just a baseball fan. It just feels wrong to see someone standing in the batter's box completely closed off to the pitcher and then some, but Brenton makes it work somehow. So I'm all for success over aesthetics. Ultimately, Brenton makes it work, and it looks like he's been playing around with his hand position a little bit recently, in my opinion. That's what I've noticed about his stance, the changes that he's trying to make and such. So he's been playing around with that, trying to get more line drive off of his bat instead of ground ball, while also maintaining a good approach in the batter's box. While he still struggles to hit breaking balls, only batting .137 against that pitch type, he's shown improvement in his ability to lay off breaking balls that are outside the zone, even though he still swings and misses frequently at breaking balls that are borderline off the plate. I think if he continues to refine his approach, his technique, and his timing at the plate, I think he'll be the next best center fielder that the Rockies have drafted and will watch run around their outfield, hopefully, like Tovar at shortstop, for the next decade plus. And the Rockies need it, especially considering the dimensions of the ballpark. It is a larger ballpark, and I think that was actually mentioned on that last little intermission clip I played. The fact that they have a larger ballpark and need guys in that outfield who can run around that outfield and get to those little weakly hit balls that are going to drop in the shallower parts of the outfield while still being able to range backwards for deeply hit fly balls and line drives is super important. Brenton easily has that ability, and I think he could easily maintain that ability over the next 5, 7, 8, 10 years. So when he's at the plate right now, at this point in his career, you're going to want to watch the way he works counts, the way he lays off balls, the way he waits back on breaking pitches in the zone. If he's doing each of those things well, he'll likely have a great day at the plate. And yeah, that's what you're going to want to watch at the plate. Everything else comes really naturally. You don't have to try and watch what Brenton Doyle does defensively or on the base pass. Defensively, you're going to want to pay attention. He might just lay out and make an absolutely spectacular catch, and you might have just been looking at your phone because you got a text. You don't want to let that happen to you when Brenton Doyle is in the lineup. And he'll also probably steal some bags too if he gets on base. You do not want to walk Brenton. He is an absolute nightmare on the base paths.
Player number five.
Player number five is Nolan Jones. At long last, there's another Nolan playing in Colorado, one that's not being paid $16 million a year to play for another team that he was traded to, thankfully. So we have another Nolan rocking purple pinstripes. This Nolan was traded for over the 2023 offseason. He was acquired from the Guardians and had actually been a top 100 prospect in all of Major League Baseball at one point in his career. So this dude is very, very highly thought of across the baseball world. So how has Nolan done at the major league level for the Colorado Rockies thus far in 2023? Well, in 24 games, he has slashed .354 with a .436 on base percentage, good for an OPS of 1.070. Four numbers in Nolan Jones's OPS. As a rookie, well, I don't know if I don't think he's necessarily a rookie because he had some playing time with the Guardians last year when he made his major league debut, but he's effectively a rookie experience-wise. He has not played very much at the major league level. He's also hit 5 home runs, driven in 14 runs. He struck out 30 times. He's walked 11 times. He's 5 for 5 in stolen base attempts, good for an OPS plus of 175. That makes him 75% better than the average MLB hitter. And like Doyle and Caracity, Jones hasn't played enough to be considered across the broader array of the MLB percentile rankings, but we do know that he's at the 93rd percentile of max exit velo, and he's in the 81st percentile in speed. So again, similar to Doyle, I don't have a comparison for Jones today, but look, if Doyle's ceiling is a future superstar, then we better put this man in the same category. I'm just saying. If we're going to say Doyle's up there, and I do say Doyle's up there, Jones better definitely be up there. Nolan is absolutely incredible. He's a five-tool player, just like Doyle, who can play corner infield and corner outfield. That positional versatility is absolutely amazing, especially for the Rockies, who really do highly value positional versatility, and they instill it within their prospects as they're coming up through the minor leagues. So it's great to see that that is something that Jones possesses, although his speed and his arm strength are best served in the outfield, particularly in right field, because he has an absolute cannon, arguably the second strongest arm besides Brenton Doyle in center field on the team. So he does play first base occasionally, but once Chris Bryant and CJ Krohn both return to the lineup, Bryant moving back to left field would be the move that makes the most sense. That's the position he played when he was an all-star in 2021. And also Jones, like I just said, is better in right field, all things considered. With Krohn returning to the lineup, he'll obviously be the everyday first baseman again. So Jones will really only have to play first base on a Krohn off day, or if they want to get him in there. I don't know why else they'd want to get him in there and waste his athleticism at first base. So I'd expect him to play less first base when Krohn gets back and gets healthy. But ultimately, the fact is that Nolan Jones is already raking at the major league level. I mean, you saw the stat line. I'll put it up again for the stream if you're still here watching. That's pretty impressive for your first 24 games. Effectively, not of your career, but with this new franchise, the new franchise that traded for you over the offseason and that new environment, to be able to come up and make an impact like this in your first 24 games with the team is amazing. And he's hitting all pitch types well. That's the great thing. It's not like he's a one-dimensional hitter like a lot of Rockies hitters are, especially some of the younger ones. So like a guy maybe like Trejo is really good at hitting breaking balls for some reason, but he can't hit fastballs. Like that would make you sort of a one-dimensional hitter. Maybe you're a guy like Randall Grichuk who hits fastballs exceedingly well and you can't hit a breaking ball in an off-speed pitch to save your life. Ultimately, the fact that Nolan is as young as he is and is already a very, very balanced hitter, and he's been able to translate that throughout the minor leagues and now at the major league level, is very, very encouraging. So he's hitting all pitch types well with a minimum average exit velo of 91 miles per hour. Just for reference, a hard hit in baseball is considered a hit that has an exit velo of 95 miles per hour at a minimum. A barreled baseball has an exit velo of 98 miles per hour at a minimum. So he's almost averaging a hard hit baseball, which is really impressive. That would obviously put him in the upper echelons of the major leagues in that category. And the funnier thing is actually that 91 miles per hour exit velo that he has, that's the lowest that he has. And it's on fastballs. He hits fastballs the softest of all the pitch types. That means he absolutely smashes off-speed and breaking pitches. That's just great. It's great to see out of a guy who's as young as he is. He's really refined his swing timing since spring training. He struggled mightily at times in spring training with picking up breaking pitches, and just swing and miss was an issue for him. If I had to summarize it, swing and miss was a big issue for him in spring training. That's ultimately why he didn't make the team out of camp. Ultimately, they also did want to get him some playing time. And with the outfield situated the way it was at the end of spring training, he was probably only going to be able to come off the bench every once in a while, which wouldn't have been good for his development and the refining of those timing mechanisms that he'd been working so hard to refine. Ultimately, it's great to see that he has a great eye at the plate as well. He's not afraid to work walks and potentially steal a base. Like we saw, he's stolen five. He's huge. I think he's like 6'4", 6'5". He's a tall human being, and he can move. And he's willing to do it. He's willing to take off. All those things considered, just my evaluation of Nolan Jones at this point in time is just sky high. There's really not much else to say about that. Overall, my suggestion to Nolan Jones is really only one. Keep it up. There's not much else you can tell a guy who's dominating all aspects of the game the way he is right now. And I hope it stays that way. So when he's at the plate, you're going to want to look for him to lay off low breaking and off-speed pitches. If there is one bugaboo for him so far, it is that his tendency is to swing at those pitches, especially in two-strike counts. Pitcher throws a nice little hook, low in the zone, slider, changeup, what have you. He's going to swing a lot more than he probably should, and I'm sure he'd say the same thing. So if he's laying off those pitches, forcing pitchers to work deep into counts, he'll likely have a very good day at the plate. Defensively, you're obviously going to watch for him to come up throwing on first to third situations where there's a runner on first and a base hit is hit to him over in right field, assuming that's where he started that evening or that day or that in that part of the lineup. Ultimately, he loves letting the cannon fly. He loves just launching cannonballs. So he's definitely not going to be hitting his cutoff man in a lot of those situations. So look for him to try and throw out runners in first to third type of situations. He loves showing off the cannon. Ultimately, in summary, the Rockies have their struggles. And that's apparent, very apparent. Most of which pertain to pitching. For the hitting perspective, it's mostly due to the fact that a lot of the contributors that are coming up from a hitting perspective are younger and they're refining their approach at the major league level. So that will obviously work itself out with time. But in terms of pitching, whether it be a guy like Austin Gomber who struggles to control his already low velocity fastball and appropriately balance his attack of hitters to account for that and counter that weakness, whether it be a guy like Matt Caricitti who needs to be able to adapt to his inability to throw a breaking pitch, whether it's a guy like Pierce Johnson who simply just throws a pitch that is ineffective at his home ballpark, the pitching has its fair share of issues, and there's definitely work to be done in that regard in all aspects and facets of the organization, from the players to the coaches to the front office to the ownership, even to take responsibility and fix and work through those issues. In terms of hitting, however, the future is very bright. Obviously, Tovar has been out being a father over the last few days, but he's definitely a part of that core that has a very, very bright future. Guys like Brenton Doyle and Nolan Jones demonstrate the Rockies' ability to develop hitters and to spot that talent and develop them both offensively and defensively throughout the minor league system. All in all, overall, the Rockies just need to find and develop pitchers who fit the mold of a successful Coors Field pitcher. I think that's a fantastic start. They need a guy who throws a low spin rate fastball, that's high velocity, a high spin rate slider, an effective changeup with good speed differential, and if they throw a curveball, preferably low spin rate on that pitch as well. That is ultimately the mold of a pitcher who can succeed at Coors Field. And what's encouraging is that at the very least, success is attainable. It doesn't always feel like that as a Rockies fan, right? We know that very well. It doesn't feel like this team will ever succeed all in all because the pitching will never be able to catch up to the hitting and the success that the hitters have. But success is attainable. And I do think that we'll just have to see if these types of successful approaches are ultimately taken. And we're just going to have to go from there in terms of how we handle being Colorado Rockies fans. But that's all she wrote on today's episode of Adjusting for Altitude. Thank you for listening to this episode. If you've made it this far in the show, I just want to remind you that your listenership is very much appreciated. And now your viewership is appreciated too, because, you know, live stream. So that's pretty cool. On the show, I do pride myself in providing Rockies fans and MLB fans alike with high quality analysis about the team from the perspective of someone who eventually wants to work in the industry of Major League Baseball as a front office executive. So all of these opinions that I've shared, unless denoted otherwise, are my own individual opinions that I've formed through lots and lots of hours of research and analysis. So as such, I really do hope you appreciate the depth and the perspective and the unique opinions that I present on this podcast that are really seldom discussed on other baseball-related outlets. Again, you can find this podcast on all major podcasting platforms. You can now find it on YouTube, Twitter, and Twitch. On Twitter, it's going to be under my personal account. I should have noted that earlier. It's not going to be under there is no Adjusting for Altitude Twitter account. So if you want to watch them on Twitter, you're going to have to go find me on Twitter at IamTheSecond. Streams will be, like I said earlier, every Monday evening, hopefully at 7. I might have to push the start time back to maybe 8 or 8:30, because it feels like with the prep and all the setup and all that, considering I do that all myself, it seems like later in the evening works better. But maybe that's something else that you guys let me know in the comments or DMs or email. However it be, until next week, I hope you take care, God bless, and go Rockies.